The Nobel Prize for Literature can be controversial, but it is always a source for new ideas for writers to read to understand world history and world literature more clearly. Today I'm starting on the Burning Archive, a little mini-series on the Nobel Prize for Literature. Welcome everyone to episode 117 of the Burning Archive, and I hope you enjoyed my interview last week with Hannah Forsyth. It was a terrific interview with a terrific Australian historian, and before that, of course, I had an interview with Felipe Fernandez Armesto, the world's best historian of the world. Three fantastic episodes. If you haven't listened to them, do check them out. If you're new here, I'm Jeff Rich. This is the Burning Archive podcast, where I look at history and culture and try to see the world more clearly with a little bit of quality history. One great way to see the world more clearly with a little bit of quality history is to pay attention to the Nobel Prize for Literature. Over the years, I've made it a bit of a habit to try to read the works of the winner of the Nobel Prize. Sometimes I would have read them before they get the award, but often the Nobel Prize is just one of those ways to be given a prompt to explore a writer you have not heard of, you do not know, but also to explore a culture, a literature, a set of traditions, historical events that you may not know. And over the next 4 or so weeks on the Burning Archive, I'm going to do a special mini series on the Nobel Prize for Literature. And this week, I'm going to kick it off by talking about the history of the Nobel Prize for Literature, some controversies, some winners, some personal favorites, and I will then do a bit of a recap of my, in fact, that history is a bit of a recap of one of the early episodes of the Burning Archive that established this little mini tradition I have now in its third year of doing special episodes on the Nobel Prize for Literature. The second part of today's episode will look at last year's winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, the French writer Annie Ernaux, who won it for, amongst other things, for The Years. And I'll add on to that recap a little bit of fresh material based on Annie Ernaux's Nobel lecture she gave on receiving the prize, something she had not delivered at the time that I produced the podcast. But do make sure you give this podcast a like, a share, a subscribe, and also, check out my YouTube channel. It's free to subscribe there. You can help me grow the channel by liking and sharing and subscribing. And you can also go to jeffrich.substack.com, where I produce a weekly newsletter, free weekly newsletter, Glimpses of the Multipolar World. So do those things and help me grow the audience of the Burning Archive. I'd love to have more people exposed to some of the great talks I've had with Felipe Fernandez Armesto and Hannah Forsyth, and to learn more about the world, to see it more clearly with a bit of good quality world history. Do sit back and relax. I'll be back at the end of the show letting you know what's coming next week with some special commemorative episodes of some earlier Nobel Prize winners. And for now, enjoy this podcast on the history of the Nobel Prize for Literature and last year's wonderful winner, Annie Ernaux, who herself writes about memory, the experience of generations, and history. So the Nobel Prize for Literature is one of the prizes that came from the will and testament of Alfred Nobel, who was a extremely wealthy businessman who I believe invented or commercialized dynamite and explosives, and perhaps out of a sense of philanthropy and good conscience, and perhaps to out of some desire to compensate for the destruction wrought on the world by all the weapons using his inventions, he gave a very large legacy that has led to 5 prizes being awarded since 1901. And so there's a prize for peace, and there's a prize for literature, which is the one we're going to focus on, and there's some other sciencey type prizes, which we won't really go into on this show. Okay, and since 1901, the Nobel Prize for Literature, which is the one we're really going to focus on. I mean, there could be some interest out there in the Nobel Peace Prize, and perhaps there's some geopolitical significance of the Nobel Peace Prize. Maybe we'll cover that in a subsequent episode. But the Nobel Prize for Literature is the focus of this show. And since 1901, the prize has been awarded 113 times. And if you're listening to the show after the 7th of October, which I guess you must be, because I'm going to release it on the 7th of October. So as of the time of you listening to this show, the prize will have been awarded 114 times to 118 recipients. Why it's more is there have been 4 shared prizes all quite a while ago. Those prizes have gone to writers who write in 25 languages and many, many countries. I'm not quite sure how many countries. The youngest ever winner of the prize was 41. I think that was Rudyard Kipling a long, long time ago. And the oldest ever winner was 88. There have been 16, possibly 17, depending on what happens later this week, winners of the prize. And the prize is worth 10 million Swedish krona, which is around about 1.1 million US dollars. So I guess somewhere, I don't know, I haven't quite got the currency conversion for me here, but let's say somewhere between 1.3 and 1.5 million dollars, Australian dollars. So pretty wealthy, good gig, but obviously its more significant status is it's you really enter the halls of Valhalla for writers when you win the Nobel Prize for Literature. Not one of my aspirations. The process for awarding the prize is at times controversial and complicated. The Nobel Committee, which is largely formed from members of the Swedish Academy, the sort of learned society of Sweden, sends out letters to select nominators, who are people like members of the Swedish Academy, professors of literature, former winners of the Nobel Prize for Literature, and presidents of author societies in all countries. And they receive these letters in September. They then sort of come up with their ideas about who should win. And those ideas are locked away secretly for 50 years, just so no one can expose the secrets of the Nobel Committee. The Nobel Committee then develop a long list of about 15 to 20 in February, winnow that down to 5 in April, and then the Academy reads the works of those 5. I don't quite know how they handle the issue of translation, but there might be something out there that explains all that. But they do their reading, and in October, having made their decision, they announce it, and then the winner of the prize receives the award in a ceremony in December, and indeed they're obliged to, in order to get the money, come and get the award and give some kind of acceptance speech. And that has been controversial on a couple of occasions, just what exactly happened, and we'll get into that. There are some criteria for winning the Nobel Prize for Literature that come from Alfred Nobel's will. Essentially, he specified 2 criteria for winning the literature prize, and they would be that the literature was to the greatest benefit of mankind, we'll just rephrase that as humankind, and that it be in an idealistic direction. So two quite ambiguous and hard to interpret criteria, and not surprisingly, there have been some swings and roundabouts, so to speak, in how those criteria have been interpreted over the years of the prize's history. Not surprisingly, there's a fair degree of interpretation that has gone on over the years in the choices of who should win the prize. The very first prize indeed was in 1901, and the winner then was a French poet and essayist, Sully Prudhomme, whose full name I think was René François Armand Prudhomme. And right from the get-go, the choice of writer was criticised because many people thought that the then still alive Leo Tolstoy should have won that 1901 Nobel Prize for Literature. But the Swedish Academy did not correct its mistake, and Leo Tolstoy died 10 or 9 years later, one of the many and perhaps the most famous writer not to win the Nobel Prize. People say that for the first 20 years or so of the Nobel Prize's existence, including the war years, First World War years, the prize reflected a kind of conservative idealism and had a bit of a Scandinavian bias. A significant number of Scandinavian writers, perhaps especially during World War I. But there were some notable winners, including Rudyard Kipling and Rabindranath Tagore, the great Bengali Brahmin and writer from India, of course. In the 1920s, people say there was a wide-hearted humanity in the approach of the Nobel Prize, reflecting perhaps a more, liberal viewpoint from then social democratic Sweden. And Sweden or Norway? Social democratic Norway. And so famous winners there include George Bernard Shaw and Thomas Mann, the great German novelist, writer of Buddenbrooks and Magic Mountain, and Dr. Faustus. In the 1930s, the prize took a more populist turn, interpreting greatest benefit of humanity in terms of, populism, including awarding the novelist Pearl Buck with a prize. And then after 1946, the prize took a more literary experimental turn, awarding pioneers like William Faulkner, author of, punctuationless type long sentences in his stream of consciousness novels of the American South, and of course the great poet T.S. Eliot, Thomas Stearns Eliot. In the 1950s and 1960s, political influences and the shadow of the Cold War hang over the prize. There are two famous refusals of the prize in 1956 or 1958 with Boris Pasternak, author of Dr. Zhivago, who I think a whole book has been written about his winning of the prize, because there were efforts from both the American side and the Soviet side to both encourage the awarding of the prize to Pasternak and then to encourage Pasternak not to go to accept the prize. And in 1964, Jean-Paul Sartre, existential Marxist that he was, also refused the prize. And then in 1970, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the great Russian dissident, was awarded the prize. In the 1970s, the
Enterprise turns a little bit more to awarding important internationally unnoticed authors from the 1990s. There's a significant change in the proportion of women awarded the prize. And after 2000, people say there's been maybe a little bit of a drift back to a European, even an English language bias in the awarding of the prize. We will see what happens in 2021. So that's a little bit of a, you know, quick run through the periods and different patterns and some of the famous winners of the prize or famous awardings of the prize. I'll just go through a couple of my favourite or winners from the period before 2010. Books I have read, know or own. And let's go all the way back to 1902. Perhaps one of the more odd winners of the prize was Theodore Mommsen, who was a historian of the Roman Empire, a very fastidious historian of the Roman Empire who studied the law and land arrangements and all that sort of thing. So it's quite curious to see him winning the Nobel Prize for Literature, but it's good to see history recognised there. In 1913, as I said, there's a recognition of non-Western traditions in the Rabindranath Tagore's writing. In 1923, William Butler Yeats won the prize, the great Irish poet, author of that great poem, The Second Coming, turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear, the falconer, things fall apart, the centre cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world, the blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. And there's also a magnificent second stanza there, but I won't read that for you, but many of you, I'm sure you will have recognised some of those lines about the centre cannot hold and the others. They are oft quoted as they should be. So let's get back to the Nobel Prize. And so in 1928, the Norwegian-Danish author Sigrid Undset won the prize. She's an author of historical fiction in sort of medieval Scandinavia. And I have one of her books, and I'm definitely, it's on my sort of shelf of books that I'm going to read that I just haven't got around to reading yet. In 1929, Thomas Mann, author of The Magnificent Magic Mountain, Der Zauberberg, and Dr. Faustus and Buddenbrooks won the prize. In 1953, Winston Churchill, former Prime Minister of England, won the Nobel Prize for Literature, not the Nobel Prize for Peace or Peace Prize, but the Nobel Prize for Literature. He was a prolific historian and obviously a magnificent speechwriter and speaker. And so we're just going through some of the favourite winners. Albert Camus in 1957, the Australian, the only Australian winner of the Nobel Prize, Patrick White in 1973, whose novels I read in puzzled and bizarre way in my teenage years. Czeslaw Milosz in 1980, the great Lithuanian poet and essayist, author of The Captive Mind, which explores the thought practices of life under totalitarianism, so relevant to today. Joseph Brodsky in 1987, the great Russian poet who lived in exile in America and whose sort of study is replicated in the apartment of Anna Akhmatova in St. Petersburg. Where I have stood twice in my life, that is Anna Akhmatova's apartment. The great Irish poet Seamus Heaney in in 1995, and the Polish poet Wisława Szymborska in 1996. Szymborska's may well be my favourite, personal favourite of all those winners, since I really discovered her through her winning the Nobel Prize. And really, that 1996 prize started off my habit of tending to buy the books of the winner of the Nobel Prize after they have been announced. Okay, so as I said before, there have been also some very famous losers or non-winners of the prize, perhaps even more distinguished than the many of the winners. So right off the bat, there's Leo Tolstoy, the great Norwegian, I think, dramatist Henrik Ibsen and August Strindberg. Both did not win the prize despite their utter importance. Paul Valéry was nominated some 20 times or something, the French essayist, I guess, and poet. James Joyce, great experimental writer of the early 20th century, didn't win the prize. José Luis Borges was nominated for the prize a dozen or more times and didn't win. Same thing with Graham Greene, W.H. Auden, Vladimir Nabokov, and the great Australian poet Les Murray was many, many times rumoured to win the prize, but never did until, sadly, death took him away a couple of years ago. And similarly, there are often reputed winners such as Muromaki and Margaret Atwood who may yet not win the prize. There have been some great controversies, some of which I've mentioned already, like Jean-Paul Sartre and refusing the prize, and the Boris Pasternak Prize in 1958. Solzhenitsyn was awarded the prize in 1970, but was unable to come to collect the prize, so he could not receive it until 1974, by which time I think he'd been exiled from the Soviet Union. And there have been some questionable decisions, like Dario Fo, or questionable and widely criticised decisions, like Dario Fo, who was a performance artist in 1997. And in 2018, there was a huge controversy over the sexual misconduct of the husband of one of the members of the committee, who was nonetheless very influential in literary affairs in, no pun intended, in Sweden, in Norway and Scandinavia. And as a result, in 2018, given the controversies and that person being effectively forced to resign, there was no prize awarded in 2018. The 2018 prize was subsequently awarded in 2019. The man who was alleged to have engaged in sexual misconduct indeed was subsequently jailed for rape and sent to a couple of years jail. I think he might still be in jail. And that has led to a number of reforms to the Nobel Prize process and the committee membership, and, you know, a general effort by the Nobel Prize, I think, as evidenced in some of the videos or the material that they're producing on the NobelPrize.org website, which is doing a little bit more to explain the purpose and meaning of the prize. We're getting close now to the countdown of the winning of the prize. So let's just quickly rattle through the last 10 winners, or the winners since 2010 of the Nobel Prize for Literature. So I'm just going to read through the winners and what they were, and the brief, wonderfully little, the commendatory sort of terms that are used to describe what they won the prize for. So in 2010, the Latin American writer Mario Vargas Llosa won the prize for his cartography of structures of power and his trenchant images of the individual's resistance, revolt, and defeat. So, yes, I've read Mario Vargas Llosa, so that's one for me. In 2011, Thomas Tranströmer won the prize. He's a Swedish poet who also, interestingly, was like, did his poetry sort of part-time and was a psychologist who worked a lot with the child welfare services in Sweden. Interesting sort of character. He won his prize because through his condensed, translucent images, he gives us fresh access to reality. And I've got some of Tranströmer's works here at home. In 2012, the Chinese short story novelist, essayist, writer Mo Yan won the prize because his hallucinatory realism merges folktales, history, and the contemporary. In 2013, I haven't read any of Mo Yan, I'm afraid to say. In 2013, Alice Munro won the prize as the master of the contemporary short story. I've read a couple of those. In 2014, Patrick Modiano won the prize. He writes a lot about the experience under French occupation during World War, or the experience of occupied France during World War II. He won the prize for the art of memory, with which he has evoked the most ungraspable human destinies and uncovered the life world of the occupation. Maybe I will actually read him one day. In 2015, the non-fiction, almost journalist, documentary type writer Svetlana Alexievich won the prize for her polyphonic writings, A Monument to Suffering and Courage in Our Time. She really documents the experiences of people surviving in the post-communist states in Eastern Europe. She was born in Ukraine and lived in Belarus at the time of the award. In 2016, Bob Dylan, famous plagiarist, minstrel for boomers, won the Nobel Prize for having created new poetic expressions within the great American song tradition. Surely the low point of the Nobel Prize in literature. But anyhow, we'll move on from there. They seem to have redeemed themselves a little bit since then. In 2017, Kazuo Ishiguro, the Japanese-English author. He was born in Japan, in Nagasaki, no less, in 1954. He won the prize. He's a novelist. Perhaps the most famous book he wrote is The Remains of the Day. Some people say he hasn't really improved since then, but that would be a bit unkind. But he's produced a number of works, but only The Remains of the Day is the one that I've read. In 2018, Olga Kazuk, a Polish novelist, won the prize for a narrative imagination that with encyclopedic passion represents the crossing of boundaries as a form of life. And I haven't read any Olga Tokarczuk because her prize was jointly announced in 2019 and I sort of didn't notice it, I'm ashamed to say. But she has written a very significant kind of historical novel around, I guess, acceptance of cultural diversity, being part of the tradition of Poland and Eastern and Central Europe. And I think one of her sort of magnum opus is about to come out in English, and it is called The Books of Jacob. So I think I might read that one, and who knows, I might even report back on the Burning Hardcuff podcast. And in the tradition of non-linear experimental narratives from the Nobel Prize, let me just jump in here from 2023 and report that, in fact, I have read now Olga Tokarczuk's The Books of Jacob. I adored it. And in fact, I'm doing a whole episode on The Book of Jacob, The Books of Jacob, and Olga Tokarczuk's writing.
as part of the mini-series coming up on the Nobel Prize. That will be in about 3 weeks' time. And indeed, since so many of the events are of the books of Jacob are set in Podolia, or what is now known as Ukraine, it will be an opportunity perhaps to reflect somewhat on the experiences of war, peace and ruin in Ukraine over the last nearly 2 years. Okay, back to the show.
And then in 2019, Peter Handke won the prize for an influential work that with linguistic ingenuity has explored the periphery and the specificity of human experience. Peter Handke is was born in Austria, lives in France, has written essays, novels, notebooks, dramatic works and screenplays. I know him of an extraordinary film that I think was a Werner Herzog film based on a play that he wrote called The Enigma of Caspar Hauser that tells the story of a boy who's sort of locked away and has no language, is sort of, you know, cruelly abused as a child and then is sort of brought back into the human community and was like a kind of cause celeb in the early 19th century. It's a magnificent film if you get a chance to look at it, because it explores, well, what is human language, what is cultural, how can there be connection and empathy between people with such different experiences. And then there was a lot of controversy about Peter Handke because he was critical of some of the interventions in Serbia, but I'm not going to get into all of that right now. Finally, in 2020, as we get very close to the announcement of the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2021, the winner in 2020 was the American poet Louise Glück, which is spelt G-L-U with the two dots, umets or whatever they're called, on top, C-K, so Glück, for her unmistakable poetic voice that with austere beauty makes individual existence universal.
After Louise Glück in 2021, it was Abdul Razak Gurnah who won the Nobel Prize for his uncompromising and compassionate penetration of the effects of colonialism and the fate of the refugee in the gulf between cultures and continents. And I did sample Gurnah's writing, but it didn't quite register with me as much as with the following winner, Annie Ernaux, who won for the courage and clinical acuity with which she uncovers the roots, estrangements and collective restraints of personal memory, very much a theme of the Burning Archive. So let's look now at my special episode on Annie Ernaux's Nobel Prize. Okay, so let's leave all that international politics behind and talk about the wonderful, rejuvenating and refreshing decision by the Swedish Academy to award the Nobel Prize for Literature to Annie Ernaux, the French writer. So on the evening of the 6th of October, I didn't do a live stream of the announcement, but I did do a live recording of my reaction to the announcement of the Nobel Prize for Literature. And initially, I was a little bit surprised and shocked that the Nobel Committee had chosen another European, Annie Ernaux. But that was perhaps a little bit shallow and callow of me, because as the announcement progressed, and as I began to learn more about Annie Ernaux, I think I discovered a writer who will be of interest of to many listeners of the podcast, and a person of genuine enduring significance. Now, one of the wonderful things about the announcement was that on the night, and I didn't include this in the clip, the Swedish Academy had to say, as they were telling the journalists and the world and the assembled podcasters watching on YouTube, that they were announcing the prize, but they had not actually been able to contact Annie Ernaux yet by phone. And in a subsequent interview, Annie Ernaux explained how she, in fact, was, I think, doing some things at home, cooking or gardening or something like that, and that she at one point turned the radio on to find out who had won the Nobel Prize, because she was interested. And it was through that announcement on the radio that she found out that she in fact had won the prize. And there are a couple of short interviews with Annie Ernaux on the internet, on YouTube, etc. The Nobel Prize YouTube channel has a wonderful little brief interview with Annie Ernaux, which I think is conducted in English as well. There's clearly French ones as well, but and she's a wonderful character, very, in a way, humble and valuable. And I think I soon converted from an initial shock that, goodness me, there was another European winner of the Nobel Prize, to real admiration for this choice of Annie Ernaux, who, as they said there, writes in, I guess, the tradition of Marcel Proust, another of my favourite writers, but in a very, very different way, and a way that emphasises, as they said, shame, but also what is almost a sort of anti-literature, a kind of focus on using writing to investigate the self, an ethnology of the self, and one in which the self is as much formed through the passing parade of social convention and objects and memories, and not just personal, like individual memories, but memories that are passed from previous generations on to following generations, from one group of people to another. And this is very much a kind of pattern that she explores in her work, The Years, which I dutifully bought on the Kindle in the morning after the Nobel Prize, because someone had already reserved it from the local library. Now, in a piece on Radio France, which is in French, but you can do a kind of a machine translation, there's a bit of a good profile of Annie Ernaux, how she was born in 1940 in Lyon, and expressed in her literature her experience as a class defector from the family grocery store to the aggregation of modern letters and bourgeois marriage, from the small town of Yvetot in Normandy in the capital, and a tender and guilty tension that she explores in her literary work. They go on to comment that Annie Ernaux is very committed to the left as a writer, left of politics, and marked French literature with the autobiographical material of her writing. And autobiography is a particularly strong tradition in French literature. There's Proust, there's Michel Lyrès, there's a number of major 20th century intellectual figures who really write that this kind of ethnology of the self. And of course, that even goes back all the way, I guess, to Michel de Montaigne, the writer of the essay. The Radio France piece goes on to comment that by dealing bluntly through a clear and suspicious writing of the seductive language effects of language of objects that could have been considered unworthy in literature, such as abortion or supermarkets, Annie Ernaux explores more broadly the themes of memory, relations of social domination, and of women. She says, in an interview with France Culture, "For me, each word must have the heaviness of experience. I seek the density of words. Thanks to words, I try to thwart all this language that classifies and hierarchizes. This is why I never use the word modest, and everything that in language is likely to classify and prioritize. I feel it, I see it, and I evacuate it." And some people say she writes a kind of collective autobiography, and that's what they talked about there. And this is very much the case with her work Les Années, or The Years, which was published in France in 2008, but I think was only translated in English. If I check my the copy that I bought on Kindle a couple of days ago in 2017. And this really gave Annie Ernaux more global sort of success, international success. And it was commented on in that little excerpt from the Nobel Committee that she, in this book, "Nowhere else does the power of social convention over our lives play such a significant role. It's been described as a sociological epic that evokes both personal memories and collective history from the 1940s to the present day, and is both autobiographical and plural, a story that is both autobiographical and plural, and that the author herself qualifies as an impersonal autobiography. She recounts through the descriptions of photos of the author, the weight of conventions, their erasure, and how much she herself found it very difficult to recognize herself in the person she was." And it is from the book The Years that I'm going to read a short section of Annie Ernaux's work to give the authors of the listeners of the Burning Archive a taste for this wonderful writer who has been rightly honoured by the Nobel Prize Committee. And I didn't really know what to expect when I started to read The Years, but right from the very first epigraph page of The Years, where I was entranced, because there Annie Ernaux has two quotations, one from José Ortega y Gasset, who was a Spanish philosopher who lived between 1883 and the mid-1950s and was a kind of proto-existentialist in some ways. And he wrote the quotation at the start of Annie Ernaux's The Years, proved instantly to have a connection to the Burning Archive. And Ortega y Gasset's words are, "All we have is our history, and it does not belong to us." Truly an excellent, enigmatic epigram. And then there is a quote from Chekhov from, I suspect it's one of his plays, I'm not entirely sure, where he says, yes, they'll forget us. Such is our fate. There is no help for it. What seems to us serious, significant, very important, will one day be forgotten or will seem unimportant. And it's curious that we can't possibly tell what exactly will be considered great and important and what will seem petty and ridiculous. And it may be that our present life, which we accept so readily, will in time seem strange, inconvenient, stupid, not clean enough, perhaps even sinful. And it's those themes of a history that is both constituent, like makes us, forms who we are, but yet is also not something that we can possess, that is broader than us, that it also has its own sort of momentum, but is also hard to recover except through the work of memory and careful ethnology of the self, as Annie Ernaux practices. And you get a view of Annie Ernaux's style in the preface to the book The Years. And I'll just read from that, but before I do, because it won't necessarily be obvious, you get also a sense of the nature of the style. There's a sort of a general comment at the start, and then there are these sort of dash-started dot points almost, sentences that are tight, plain language, but precise descriptions of memory and snippets of culture, fragments of experience that are kind of just set down almost in a list-provoking memory, almost as sort of research notes into her own sense of who she is. Not only who she is, but who the collective biography, the people who she has shared those years with are. And it is it is that study of the post-World War II generation in France, Annie Ernaux being born, you know, in the midst of the war and really growing up in life after the war. So she says if I read briefly from the book, all the images will disappear. The woman who squatted to urinate in broad daylight behind the shack that served coffee at the edge of the ruins in Yvetot after the war, who stood skirts lifted to pull up her underwear and then return to the cafe. Dash. The tearful face of Alida Valli as she danced with George Wilson in the film The Long Absence. Dash. The man passed on a Padua sidewalk in the summer of 1990, his hands tied at the shoulders, instantly summoning the memory of thalidomide prescribed to pregnant women for nausea 30 years before, and of a joke people told later, an expectant mother knits the baby's layette while gulping thalidomide pills at regular intervals, a row, a pill, a row, a pill. A friend says in horror, stop, don't you realise your baby may be born without arms? And the other answers, it's okay, I don't know how to knit sleeves anyway. Dash, Claude-Pierre Plou, who leads a regiment of legionnaires, waving a flag in one hand and leading a goat with the other in a film with Les Chalot. Dash, the majesty of the elderly woman with Alzheimer's who wore a flowered smock like all the residents of the old folks' home, but with a blue shawl over her shoulders, tirelessly pacing the corridors, haughty like the Duchess of Guermont in the Bois de Boulogne, and who made you think of Celeste Abberet as she appeared one night on television with Bernard Pivot, Duchess of Guermont. I'm just adding there, of course, is a reference to Proust's In Search of Lost Time. On an outdoor stage, the woman shut into a box, pierced all the way through by men with silver spears and emerging alive because it was a magic trick called the martyrdom of a woman. And so it goes on. Many of these little points, which are, as she says, images, real or imaginary, that follow us all the way to sleep. They will vanish all at the same time, like the millions of images that lay behind the foreheads of the grandparents dead for half a century, and of the parents also dead, images in which we appeared as a little girl in the midst of beings who died before we were born, just as in our own memories, our small children are there next to our parents and schoolmates, and one day we'll appear in our children's memories among their grandchildren and people not yet born. Like sexual desire, memory never stops. It pairs the dead with the living, real with imaginary beings, dreams with history. So one of the traditions of the Nobel Prize is that the winner delivers a lecture in Sweden on receipt of the prize, and this Nobel lecture is generally published, although there have been quite a few recipients who have either not delivered it in person or been unable to deliver it for one reason or another. But Annie Ernaux showed her integrity and did deliver the Nobel lecture. Let me just read two brief sections of that Nobel lecture as a way to sort of sign off on a fine winner of the Nobel Prize in 2022. She begins the lecture by saying, "Where to begin?" Obviously, she wrote it in French. This is the English translation. But where to begin? I have asked myself this question dozens of times, gazing at a blank page as if I needed to find the one, the only sentence that would give me entry into the writing of the book and remove all doubts in one fell swoop, a sort of key. And she talks about her experience growing up as part of landless labourers, factory workers and shopkeepers, and how becoming a writer was for her a way of liberation and a way perhaps also to redress the social injustice linked to social class at birth. That was her sense of things. An individual victory, she writes, could erase centuries of domination and poverty, an illusion that school had already fostered in me by dint of my academic success. How could my personal achievement have redeemed any of the humiliations and offences suffered? And that desire to be authentic to that experience, I guess, shines through in Annie Ernaux's writing. And then towards the end of her lecture, she does say that she does not confuse the political action of literary writing subject to its reception by the reader with the positions I feel compelled to take with respect to events, conflicts, and ideas. And she expresses concern that in today's world, where the multiplicity of information sources and the speed at which images flash past condition a form of indifference, to focus on one's art is a temptation. But meanwhile, in Europe, an ideology of withdrawal and closure is on the rise. She is concerned that this ideology requires a duty of extreme vigilance for me and all those for whom the value of a human being is always and everywhere the same. And so she sees her individual prize as a collective victory, something that she shares. I share the pride of it with those who, in one way or another, hope for greater freedom, equality and dignity for all humans, regardless of their sex or gender, the colour of their skin and their culture, and with those who think of future generations, of safeguarding an earth where a profit-hungry few make life increasingly unlivable for all populations. So thank you, Annie Erno, for your wonderful contribution to culture. And next week on the Bernie Archive podcast, we are looking at another Nobel laureate, but not from last year, but from 100 years ago, from 1923. Yes, the next two podcasts on the Bernie Archive will be the winner of the Nobel Prize from 100 years ago and the winner of the Nobel Prize from 50 years ago. And those two individuals are William Butler Yeats in 1923, the great Irish poet, who I think I might have mentioned in the course of this podcast, and Patrick White, the only Australian ever to win the Nobel Prize, so far at least, who won the prize in the heat of the nationalist cultural revival in Australia in 1973. And these will be a terrific trip down memory lane. And then, and two treasured writers who've certainly had an impact on my experience of literature. And then after that, I'm doing my episode on Olga Tokarczuk and the books of Jacob. So do please like, share and subscribe the podcast. Join me at theburningarchive.com and at jeffrich.substack.com and at the Burning Archive YouTube channel. Show your support for big ideas in culture and history. It's free to subscribe to my weekly newsletter, to the YouTube channel, and indeed to my WordPress blog. And if you like, you can also support me with a paid subscription at the Substack. And until then, everyone, until next week, do remember, what thou lovest well will not be reft from thee.